the essential ingredients for growth. And first of all, I want to define, when I'm talking about growth, the areas of growth that I want to cover this morning. They are individual growth, that is, growth in maturity. That's God's goal for every single one of us, and all of those of us who are leaders. Our goal should be for those that we are seeking to lead is their own individual maturity and growth in God. That is the object of the exercise of leadership. Leadership is not to bring a kind of dependence on people, but to bring them into interdependence. Just as the goal of every parent is to be able to guide their children into maturity, then that is the responsibility for every leader. There was an old woman who lived in a shoe. She had so many children, she didn't know what to do. What was her problem? One could say, well, unsuitable accommodation. If she had a size 10 boot instead of a size 5, then she would be able to solve her problem. Or perhaps she didn't have any men around. Where was the father in this epic of the old woman who lived in a shoe? If she only had father figures around, then she wouldn't have the problem. Or perhaps she should have exercised some sort of responsible birth control and not to have so many children. I want to say that the problem was not any of those. The problem was that they were all children. If they were mature, grown up, they would be able to run the shoe. And she would be able to stick her feet up and earn a well-earned rest, no doubt. So the problem was that they were all children. And if that's a problem that we're trying to grapple with in our churches, that we've got so many children, we don't know what to do, then the problem is not that we've got a lot of people, the problem is that they are still children. Corporate growth, that is growing up together. And then thirdly, numerical growth, growing in size. Now those are three areas that I'm going to cover this morning. And what I'm doing basically is giving you a sort of checklist. I'm not showing to you this morning, and I'm sorry if you've come with that kind of question in mind, how to do this. All I'm doing is providing you with a checklist so that you can look at what is happening in your own life, in your own fellowship, and measure out, see where you need to work. Okay? So these are the three areas that we'll be looking at. And the three are linked and dependent on each other. They are consequential and should be concurrent. Now that sounds complicated, but what it simply means is this, that the three areas of individual growth, of corporate growth, and of numerical growth are linked together and are dependent upon each other. In other words, we're not going to speak to get corporate growth, a growing together, unless there is individual growth happening in people's lives. Because if people are still being childish in their individual lives, when you put them together, they will be just squabbling, just as the Corinthian church was squabbling together like children. So if we're going to experience corporate growth, then there must be a measure of individual growth. And if we're going to see numerical growth, again, there must be some semblance of individual growth and corporate growth. Now, they are dependent upon each other, and they are consequential. But they should be concurrent. In other words, we don't reach a stage where we have grown individually, and then we say, now the next part is to grow corporately, and when we've done that, the next part is to grow numerically. It doesn't happen that way. Or it shouldn't happen that way. We should be growing individually all the time. We should be growing corporately together all the time. And we should be growing numerically all the time. So they should be concurrent. These things should be going on all the time. But there can be times when God is clearly speaking that the emphasis should be in this direction for this particular period. So it may well be that God may say to you that for this particular stage in your development, you need to concentrate on this particular one. For example, as far as our own fellowship is concerned, God has spoken to us about concentrating on the last one, numerical growth. It doesn't mean we've got all the answers and we've arrived at some sort of state of maturity in terms of individual or corporate growth, but we have reached this particular stage and God is making this particular emphasis at this particular time. So the three are linked, but they should be going on all the time, although God may say at some particular time, I want you to concentrate here. The next thing that I want to put as basic to the philosophy of the whole thing is that growth is natural. We have lived for many years in this country where we have seen decline in terms of growth, especially numerical growth. That for years, churches and denominations every year have experienced decrease in numbers. And that's what we have grown used to. We've even made a theology of it, the theology of the last days. When Jesus Christ comes, shall he find faith on the earth? The love of many will grow cold, etc., etc., etc. Therefore, because we have made this theology, we expect, in actual fact, for decline. And what we have to do is to maintain the witness until Jesus comes. We put up the barriers, we go into our fortress and pull up the drawbridge. We occasionally let it down to make incursions onto the world outside, do a few raids, get them back in, and slam up the drawbridge again. And that's the kind of mentality that we have. And if we manage to rescue one or two, then hallelujah. But basically, things are going to get worse and worse and worse, and things are going to decline. So we do not expect growth to happen. Now, that has been the prevalent mood within the church in this country for many, many years. And it's very, very difficult to get out of that in actual fact. Because even though we may say things, the history and the heritage of the whole thing really does come out in many, many ways. But growth is natural. And when we look at the parables of the kingdom, for example, the parable of the sower, the parable of the mustard seed, the parable of the yeast, we see there that when Jesus is talking about the kingdom, he is talking about growth taking place. That the ingredients for growth are present within. Now let me emphasize this. The ingredients for growth are present within. Too often, we are looking for the ingredients out there somewhere to enable us to grow. Understand what I mean? We're looking for something that out there which will enable us to grow. Now, the ingredients for growth are present within. A reference was made by Paul last night to the parable of the sower. When the disciples saw the need out there, and they said to Jesus, "We really ought to do something about that." And Jesus said, "You give them to eat." And their immediate reaction was, the ingredients are out there. If we had more, then we might be able to do it. If we had better facilities, if we had more ministries, if we had more money, and we get into an if mentality. And Jesus simply said, "What have you got?" That the ingredients for growth were actually already there. And I believe that the ingredients for growth are for your individual growth, for corporate growth, or for numerical growth are already there. I believe, and I work to this basic philosophy, that the ingredients for growth are right there. That you don't have to look anywhere else than the resources that you've actually got. I believe that God has given us sufficient resources within us, as a group, as a fellowship, to do what he wants to do at this particular moment in time. Okay? I don't believe that God is a kind of frustrating God that gives us a task or gives us a kind of hangs out something that there aren't the sufficient resources already present to reach. I don't believe that. The church is an organism, and one of the basic characteristics of an organism is that it has the ability to grow and reproduce. It has a life force within it. I mentioned about the corn of wheat. There is a life force present within. All it needs is the right environment for that to be released. And within us and within the church, there is a life force already in. And that means there is already in a power to reproduce. Because that's what organism is all about. Organizations do not have that. But organisms do. They have the ability to reproduce. There is a life force. And secondly, there is a life principle. And the life principle is this, that it has power to produce like character. That if you're a gardener and you plant carrots, not only is there a life force within it to reproduce, but like character, you will get carrots. It would be very interesting if you got tomatoes when you planted carrots, but the life principle is not only that it will reproduce, given the right environment, but it will reproduce like kind, like character. And so the seed that God has planted within our own lives, that seed not only has power to reproduce in our own life, but it has power to reproduce like kind. I've said of my daughter, she suffered from two disabilities in life. One is she looks like me, and the other she behaves like me. Now, that happens because she has my seed in her. My son, my second son, my oldest son, fortunately doesn't have that. He has more of my wife in him. More of her character than he does me. Now, she doesn't have to struggle to be like me. Her struggle is not to be like me. You see the principle? The life force has power to reproduce and power to reproduce like character. And the life force that God has placed within the church is the Holy Spirit. And therefore it follows that the Holy Spirit has power to reproduce and power to produce like character, Christ-like character. So growth, whether it is individual growth, whether it is corporate growth or numerical growth, is a natural consequence. It does happen, although it may happen in a supernatural way. The principle of life, the principle of growth, is already there. The life force and the life principle. And growth should take place if conditions for growth are present and hindrances to growth are removed. When we look at the parable of the sower, the problem was not with the seed, the problem was not with the sower. The problem was where the seed fell. And in certain cases, it fell in ground that was not conducive for its growth. Sometimes there was hindrance to growth, an underlying rocky strata or thorns or whatever. So growth should take place if conditions for growth are present and hindrances to growth are removed. Now that's, I think, the basic starting point when we start to consider growth. That growth is not a strange thing, but growth ought to be taking place. Now, I want to look now at those three areas. First of all, individual growth. And I want to ask certain questions And these are the questions. Am I growing? Now, if you are a leader, that is a question that you need to ask yourself. Am I growing? If you are not growing, your people will not be growing. Your people will not grow beyond where you are growing. The key to any growth is to be found in the leadership. A church will not grow beyond its leadership. It will not get any more spiritual than its leadership. It will not get any more envisioned than its leadership. It will not be any more committed than its leadership. There is another principle that we need to see in terms of growth. I was talking to a group of leaders. I forget exactly what it was about, but maybe say loyalty. And I said to them, I can absolutely guarantee how you can produce loyalty in your people. Loyalty or commitment or whatever quality that you want to see. So their ears pricked up and their eyes opened. Said, how? Whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. If you want to see loyalty, then what you have to do is to sow loyalty. You have to give loyalty. If you want to see commitment, then give commitment. If you want to see generosity, then be generous. Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. That is a God-given principle that you cannot shortcut. I was, a few years back, greatly challenged by the sense of loyalty that I had from team who was working with me. People who were working with me, or for me in a sense. And I thought, now why is it? Why? And I realized, in all honesty, it was because I was very loyal to them. And whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. And I meet sometimes frustrated leaders because they're wanting this, that, and the other from people. And the reason why they're not getting it is they're not sowing it. Whatever a man sows, that will he reap. And the question is, am I growing? And therefore, are others growing in maturity and in ability? And if within us as leaders, there is an attitude that I am wanting to grow, I am willing to grow, I'm ready to grow, that will be reproduced in the people. And if you are not willing to grow, and if you are not in a position where you are able to grow, then the people around you will not be growing. One of the tragedies when it so often happens in leadership is once you get into leadership, you stop growing. Because you don't put yourself in an environment, in a position where you're able to grow. Now, when Jesus washed the feet of Peter, or came to wash the feet of Peter, Peter said, no, you're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus said this, listen to it carefully. If I don't wash your feet, you have no part in me. And Jesus was saying to Peter this, look, Peter, your future ministry does not depend upon your willingness to minister, but your willingness to be ministered to. And you will minister to the extent to which you are ministered to. So if you're not in a position where you are being ministered to, then to that extent people will not be receiving ministry. So you must be prepared to be in a position where you can be ministered to, and you can be ministered to, if you want to, from anybody. Really, from anybody. Right, so that's the question. Are others growing in maturity, in ability? Can I just say something about growing? Because it's very difficult to measure whether you are growing or whether other people are growing, isn't it? When you've got kids, people come along and say, "My, haven't they grown?" You say, "Have they? I haven't noticed." Well, unless you've got something that you can measure growth by, if you've put little marks in your kitchen or something on the doorpost where, you know, Joe, when he was this high and when he's this date, then you've got some tangible measure of how much they've grown. Otherwise, unless you have to buy new shoes for them every 6 months, you're not really aware of whether they've grown or not. So we need something, really, to measure against whether people have grown. And the difficulty is finding something tangible. We see where we ought to be growing to, because we're told that the measure is the fullness of the stature of Christ. But when we look at that, that becomes a little bit daunting. I want to suggest to you, you know, we can look at people where they are and where they ought to be, and the gap seems absolutely enormous, and we don't think that they're growing, and maybe we don't think we're growing ourselves. A more accurate measurement is to see where people are and where they've come from. You see, if you looked at the Corinthian church and saw where they were and where they'd got to go, it was an enormous gap. And you think, "My, are they growing at all?" Sometimes when you have your children right at the early age, you know, and you go in and they seem so quiet, and you wonder whether they stop breathing and whether they're alive. Now, the question is not so much where they are to where they've got to go, it's where they are to where they've come from. And if you looked at the Corinthian church with that kind of measurement, it was a lot more encouragement than looking at it there. And to be honest, where a lot of Christians are coming from today is a long way further back than many of us have had to come from, even if we've come from a non-Christian background. I came from a non-Christian background, but at least it was a Christian non-Christian background. Do you understand what I mean? It had Christian values, even though it wasn't Christian. But today, people who are coming from a non-Christian background, it's really coming from a non-Christian background. Am I growing, or are others growing in maturity and in ability? Now, growth will take place if there's the right stimulus for growth. And that means the right environment for growth. And the right environment for growth is simply love, security, example, training, food, experimentation. I want to, again, your leaders, I'd like to give you another cast iron guarantee. That's two I'm giving you today. But most of you who are leaders and are concerned for people you are leading would like to see your people coming in to the peace of God, the well-being and the peace of God, wouldn't you? Okay, now, it's a very simple way to do it. All you need to do is to go and stand before your people and say this, that Paul said in Philippians 4:9. Whatever you have heard or learned or received, or seen in me, put into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. Okay? So you go back to your people when you next see them and say, "Now look, folks, you want the peace of God? Right. Whatever you hear from me, whatever you see in me, you put into practice, and the result of that will be the God of peace will be with you." Very simple, isn't it? What we do instead is say, "Well, folks, don't look at me, look at Jesus. Now, there must be example. That's the way children learn, either for their good or their ill, is they learn from their older brothers or they learn from other children. There must be example. There must be training. There must be experimentation. And part of experimentation must be the ability to be able to make mistakes. Okay? If your people do not feel that they're able to make mistakes, then what they will do is they will stay with what is safe. They won't experiment. Now, we have got to ensure that where they experiment, if they do make mistakes, it won't do them too much damage if they fail, or it won't damage other people too much. In other words, if somebody is going to learn to drive, you don't put them on the M1. You find some place which is relatively free from traffic where they can experiment and their failures are not going to be too drastic. So if a person is going to experiment in a gift or a work or a service, you know, maybe public speaking, that you don't shove them up before the whole church on a Sunday morning by way of experiment. Because if they blow it, as most of us do when we first start, we can be so mortified that we won't do it again. Now, sometimes that would be a good thing if we did, you know, in a sense. But I was telling somebody yesterday of the story of the young preacher who, you know, went up in the pulpit to preach for the first time, and he just walked the way up there and got in, and he absolutely blew it. So when he came down, he sort of staggered down, total humiliation. A wise old saint said to him, "If you'd have gone up like you'd have come down, you'd have gone up like you came down." Or you'd have come down like you've gone up. Yeah. So there must be that opportunity for experimentation. There must be the training. Now, I'm writing a book on apprenticeship, which is basically discipleship, which I hope is coming out next year. And when I was writing this book, I went out for a walk down by the river with the dog, and I saw a man standing on the bank teaching his children to row. The kids were in the boat, and he was yelling instructions at them. And they were squabbling, and, you know, and the boat was going around in circles, and the guy on the bank was nearly leaping up and down in frustration and shouting louder. And the thing was chaos. A little bit earlier, I'd seen a man teaching his child to row. And he was in the boat. The child was sitting between his legs. And the child had his hands on the oars as well. And they were just going along together. They were both enjoying it. The child was picking up the rhythm and the skill and everything else. And they were just going. They were enjoying it. Minimum amount of frustration. And the boat was actually going in the direction it was supposed to be going. And I thought to myself, now that's typical, the first one, typical church. That you get somebody at the front shouting instructions at what people ought to be doing. And getting more and more frustrated when they're not doing it. And inside these people, there's a little voice that's going, how? Please tell me how. Please show me how. Ever got that kind of feeling? And I've done this with groups. I said, how many of you have been told you ought to be witnesses? All the hands go up. How many of you actually have been taught how to be witnesses? Fewer hands go up. How many of you actually been taken out on a job and trained how to be witnesses? Hardly any. And so this frustration builds up on the part of the person who's telling them what they ought to be doing, and on the part of the people who know or feel what they ought to be doing, but nobody has actually trained them how. When I was in Yugoslavia, I was a typical European pastor, and they tend to do everything themselves. you know, from the flowers, everything, themselves. And I realized that all the communist authorities had to do, because he was a bit of a thorn in their flesh, was simply remove him. And the whole thing would have collapsed, because it was so dependent on this one guy. And I was really concerned about this, prayed a lot about it. One day he came to me, and he said, I've got a call to go and pray for somebody who's in the church who's sick. Will you come with me? I said, no. He sort of looked at me a bit blank. And I said, you take one of your men with you. And let that man see you praying for the sick. And next time you'll be able to send him, because he knows how to do it. And make sure he takes somebody with him as well. And you see what happens. And a disciple saw Jesus praying, and they said, Lord, teach us to pray. That looks good. How'd you do it? So training is absolutely essential. So the right environment for growth. Secondly, there must be a strategy for growth. I want to ask a question. Is there a strategy for individual growth, for your own personal growth, and for the growth of others in your church, in your fellowship? Is there a strategy for growth? And if it's essential for leaders to grow, is there the strategy, is there the place where you as leaders are able to grow also? If not, what happens is growth starts taking place here, right? And eventually it catches up with you. And you become a kind of cork in the bottle. Often the problem with leaders is that they're too busy to grow. You know, we look upon that as a kind of our own personal growth as a sort of luxury that we cannot afford because of time. I want to say to you, it's absolutely essential. Absolutely essential. When we used to meet the leadership of team of our fellowship, which I was a part then, we used to have times just for ourselves as individuals, where we would give time to one of the team, where we would dispense with business. There's always a tremendous amount of business, but just to find out where, say, I was, anything that I was working on that I needed help on. And we would schedule that in our diaries on a regular basis, so that we didn't feel guilty about using the time because there was so much to do. And we would schedule that in as part of our strategy. Now, you know, if there's four or five in a team, then once every month or whatever it comes around to your time, we wouldn't keep to it so dogmatically that if somebody else was in greater need that that person couldn't come in. But we scheduled it in as part of our strategy, in order that we could grow. And I believe that if you're leaders, you need to schedule in somewhere as part of your strategy the opportunity that you must have in order to grow. Hindrances to growth. Now, there are many hindrances to growth, and I want to cover just four areas. First of all, sin. Sin basically is a point of disobedience. That needs to be resolved if growth is going to take place. It's like if you put your finger on an artery and you exert pressure, then you stop the life flow. And eventually, the hand is going to wither. And when a person sins and it's not resolved, it acts as a kind of pressure on the life flow. It's a quenching of the Holy Spirit. And we keep on sinning in that area, and eventually it's going to stem it all together, and we're just going to die in that particular area. The second one is hurts. I'm talking here about emotional hurts that we experience, either in our past or in our present. It is not wrong to be hurt. Okay? There's nothing wrong with us if we feel hurt. The question is what we do about our hurt. Whether we simply, for most of us, we get hurt. Anger is simply a reaction to feeling hurt. That's what it is. Okay, that's what anger is. And it's not a question of dealing so much with the anger, or that may need to be dealt with, but what actually has created the anger, the hurt. And what we do when the Bible talks about three aspects of anger. The one which is like a straw fire. It's out. It's open. Wham! The other is a slow burning one. And the other kind of anger, which the Bible talks about, is a righteous anger. That is, a desire to see justice done. Right? It's nothing personal in it, it's a desire to see justice done. Now, somebody has said this, and it's absolutely true, that amongst Christians, there is a fear of that kind of anger. Right? There's a fear of it. There is a scarcity of righteous anger, indignation. And there is a surplus of resentment. Because what for most of us do as Christians, we feel it's wrong to be angry. So what we do is we suppress it. And what happens to that is it basically becomes resentment. It turns into criticism, cynicism, bitterness. And it stems away. But basically, all that is a result is we feel hurt in some area of our life. And unless we get at the hurt and deal with it, then we're going to have problems. So hurts in our life, emotional hurts. A child who's always been told, you're never going to be any good. You know, and grows up with that kind of hurt or rejection or lack of love or whatever it is. Medically, they have found, very interesting, that there is a disease which bears all the hallmarks, all the symptoms of malnutrition. All the same physical symptoms. And basically, it comes from a lack of love. That if there is not there the real love, then there is no stimulus to growth, no healthiness in growth. So emotional hurts that need to be dealt with. Bondages. Now, a bondage is anything that prevents us from being or doing what God wants us to do. Okay? That's a bondage. Whether it's a habit, whether it's fear or whatever. I suppose what you could write above 20th century man and describe 20th century man is neurotic. That man is more governed by his anxieties than anything else. And he learns to live within those anxieties. He learns to accommodate them. And we live in that kind of environment. We live by our fears. And I get people who come to me and say, well, you know, basically the thing I'm afraid of, if so-and-so happens, this will happen. And I say to them, you're not supposed to be living by your fears, but by faith. And I am not going to accommodate your fears. We need to deal with the fear. The environment that we are living in as Christians, or should be living in, is not the environment of our anxieties and our fears, but the environment of faith. But I suspect that for most of us, that is a foreign environment in which we venture like snorkel divers on occasions to view it and then come up gasping for air and live up here in the environment of our anxieties. Paul says, now I'm crucified with Christ, and the life I now live, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me. That's the environment that we ought to be operating, moving, and having our being. Right? The environment of faith rather than of our fears. Our bondages. Because basically, what we do with our fears is we avoid them. If a child believes that in the cupboard in its bedroom is a bogeyman, then the child will learn to live its life avoiding going into the cupboard or anywhere near the cupboard in case what they fear most actually is there. And what you have got to do is to face your fear. to have somebody maybe take you by the hand and open the cupboard and say, there. You can't rationalize your fear. Of course there's no bogeyman. There's no such, theologically, there is no such things as bogeyman. As long as you fear, right, as long as you fear, that will govern what is in the cupboard. And that's how you'll live your life, avoiding it. And somebody may have to take you by the hand, very gently, and open the cupboard. And until you discover that your fears are not realized, there will always be a bogeyman. And look, folk, there actually may be a bogeyman in the cupboard. So if the thing that I fear is rejection, for example, then I will skirt round anything that is likely to bring me into a place where I might be rejected. I'll be Mr. Nice Guy. Okay? So I'll avoid that. And what I'm actually fearing is that in that cupboard, I might discover something which justifies my rejection. Okay? That says I am worthless, that I am nothing. That's what I'm afraid of. Like a wife of a Christian leader, I said to her, you've got real ability, you've got real talent. And she said, oh, I leave that to my husband. And I said to her, why? What are you afraid of? And she looked at me and she said, failure. That was her hiding place. Where Adam was hiding behind the trees, that was his hiding place. That was his alibi, not was where he was supposed to be. And he was there because of his fear, not because he was there by God's appointing. And we carve ourselves out a little niche where we feel comfortable to accommodate our fears. Understanding me? We'll go on. So, and then the demonic. Now, needs must be met, not just fed. Okay? Needs must be met, not just fed. Do you know the difference between? Let me explain. I need a car to get me from A to B. That's a need. Now, if my need is to be met, I need a car to get me from A to B. However, because I'm lacking in self-esteem and self-value, if I move from A to B in a Rolls Royce, then not only will my need be met, but also my need will be fed to give me a status, to give me a value, to give me a whatever, clout. Understand? And half the time, what we're doing with people we're trying to help is we're just feeding needs, not rather than meeting needs. And we really need to get at the basic, what is the root of the problem, not the fruit of the problem. You see, a person who lacks real value and real attention and real love, you can spend hours and hours and hours with them. Because the counsel that you give them is feeding their need for attention rather than meeting the need. And the healing has to be walked out, action taken to rectify and restore. Now, the difference, the danger of an overemphasis on individual growth is this. An overemphasis on individual growth will create self-centeredness, introversion, a distortion of the gospel. It will become a man-centered thing rather than a God-centered thing. The question that I asked our folk on one occasion was this, or I asked a person, do you want God in your life, or do you want your life in God? Do you want God to fulfill you, or do you want to be fulfilled in God? Now, on the face of it, it may seem the same thing. It's poles apart. Because on the center, and God as somebody who is there to help me achieve my center, whereas the other puts God at the center and me coming into God. Whether I want God to fulfill me or my life fulfilled in God, do you see the difference? And we need to be very careful that we are not just creating a man-centered situation. because all we're doing is storing up trouble for ourselves in the future. So an overemphasis on individual growth can create that sort of problem. It becomes a man self-centered introversion, that God is there to meet my kind of needs. We become need-orientated. The way that we preach becomes need-orientated rather than God-orientated. The emphasis of gifts becomes on individualism rather than upon God. Now, an under-emphasis on individual growth will create a failure to mature, a failure to take responsibility, weak leadership, and a lack of corporate and numerical growth. Now, in putting all this down, basically I'm giving you that as a kind of pattern that you can look at. You can look at your own life, maybe you can look at the people that you're leading and say, ask the right kind of questions to see if there is a danger of you overemphasizing. Now, those are, you know, the danger of overemphasis, the danger of underemphasis. Those are the two extremes. There may be, you know, you're not getting it right in the middle somewhere, but. Right, the next. You still with me? You're understanding all right? Okay. Let's look at corporate growth, which is growing together. Growing up together. Again, let's look at the stimulus for growth. The stimulus for growth, the environment, sorry for the spelling, the environment, relationships are absolutely essential. And those relationships must be on the basis of personal relationships rather than functional relationships. Now, let me explain the difference. I guess the sort of relationship that we have, most of us have with the milkman, is a functional relationship. He is there to supply a need. Okay? I mean, you may say, hello, George, or whatever. Actually, we've lived in our house for over 3 years. We've never seen the milkman. He comes too early in the morning. He leaves us what we need. We leave a check for him, what he needs. And we never actually meet. I don't know what he looks like. He doesn't know what we look like. We have a functional relationship. He seems quite happy about it. Why should I bother? I get the milk. You know, that's the kind of relationship. Might even leave him a tip for Christmas. I think we probably do. But a personal relationship is not based upon function. It's based upon something quite different. Who that person is to you and a knowing that person. Unfortunately, most or a lot of churches have with their pastors a kind of functional relationship. The same sort of relationship that you have with a milkman. As long as he delivers the goods and doesn't wake you up too early, then you're happy. But should he forget to deliver the double cream that you asked for, then you dispense with him and you change your milkman. And we relate to people on that kind of functional basis. We want to know what their ministry is. We operate in a kind of what I call a cattle market syndrome. Whether a person is a good milker or not. Whether he's run dry. And if he is, you send him to the knacker's yard. There's no real concern for the person involved in it. Now, if you've got that kind of relationship, you've got real problems for corporate growth. Real, real problems. If you're in leadership and you're under leadership living up to people's expectations because you've got to deliver the goods, you're in real problems, because there'll be times when you can't deliver the goods. And you need to say to people, hey folks, I can't deliver the goods. And they say, that's all right. Doesn't matter. That's happened to me more than one occasion in our own fellowship. And I feel free to be able to do that. That enables us to grow as people. So the basis of the relationship must be personal, and the basis of corporate growth in our relationship together must be commitment to one another because we feel God has joined us together. It cannot be on the basis of vision. Right? You see, when two people get married, they have a vision of what marriage is going to be. Maybe they share the same vision. Maybe they don't. We get married for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer. Let's be honest, most of us think it's going to be for richer and for better. It doesn't always work that way, does it? Now, if you get married and the basis of your relationship is just vision, what happens if the vision does not materialize? The answer is the relationship disappears. Right? So you can get married with a certain expectation. But if that expectation is not realized, what happens then? There has got to be something more. And unless at the heart of it there is a commitment, because you know that God has joined you together, and whatever the outcome of the vision, God has put you together for His purpose. And maybe together you will discover what the real heart and the real vision of God is, then you're in business. Okay? Otherwise you're in struggle. And when we started, people had all sorts of expectations of what we were going to be. You know, there was going to be a greater freedom of worship. It was going to be this and that. And I said, what happens if it's not? What happens if down the road they have greater freedom of worship? What happens then? You see, there must be something more. And we reached a stage after a year of working through some real problems in terms of relationship and leadership, where we could say, as a group who were left at the beginning in the leadership, that we're together for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, because we believe God has joined us together for His purpose. And the basis of all that commitment is to love one another, to accept one another, to forgive one another, as God has forgiven us in Christ. Now, you just start to think how God has loved you, how God has accepted you, how God has forgiven you, then apply that in your relationship to each other. That's the environment in which is absolutely necessary if there's going to be a stimulus for growth and interaction of life together. Right? There must be interaction of life. That you cannot grow corporately together unless there is interaction of life together, not just on a Sunday. Okay? That has got to be. The problem has been, you see, I'll talk about this a little bit later. Strategy for growth. There must be opportunity for interaction. There must be the use of gifts and ministries, and there must be the development of gifts and ministry if there are going to be corporate growth. Let's look quickly at hindrances to growth. The social environment in which we live, the social, cultural, and traditional environment in which we live in our Western society is a real hindrance, right, to corporate growth. See, what has happened in our society over the years is this. We used to be largely a agricultural nation. And agriculture was done. We lived in villages that people related together in small communities. And right at the heart of that small community was the church. And so when people worshipped together on a Sunday, it was an extension of the relationship that they experienced in their life in their community during the rest of the week. Then we got the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution brought in the urban sprawl. And what happened slowly over the period was that people came together to worship, but they had no previous relationship with one another. And so they came together as strangers to worship. and what Colin Urquhart calls billiard ball Christians who click together on Sunday and then go to their separate pockets. Now that was part of what happened in our life, in our society, socially and culturally. That was its effect. And we even made a theology out of it, that worship then became very individual. And you came to church in your own private little aura, which you sought to preserve. And you didn't talk to anybody on either side. Not out loud, anyway. And you immediately went into this, kind of creating this special aura, and you worship God in your own private individualistic way. And to be really spiritual, you close your eyes so that you couldn't see anybody. Okay. And that was worship. That was foreign. It's quite foreign to what worship is all about in the Bible. And thank God for most of what we experience today. But it came out of lack of relationship. And worship needs to be an extension of our relationship, not the means to create relationship. The social environment in which we live, traditions that we have which cut against that, cultural things, those are all hindrances. Relationship problems unresolved. We must resolve relationship problems. Otherwise, we simply bury them. Or as Dave Matthews, I think it is, says, we sweep them under the carpet. Which means that maybe we can walk over them all right, but others are coming and bound to trip over them. And so we need to deal with them. Failure to develop or use gifts and ministry, giving room to Satan. That reference in Ephesians 4 is spoken in the context of corporate relationship, giving room to Satan. And it's not just a question of giving him an opportunity. The word room actually means giving him a place. Giving him a place in our community. Giving him a place in our relationship. And that is spoken very right up against not dealing with anger, unresolved anger. And let me say this. If you've got unresolved anger, you've buried it, become resentment or whatever, that is one of the main rooms that Satan will use. I was taking a church weekend last weekend, and a couple leaders came in the church, and you know, they had lots of problems, in quotes, with the church. Let me make a statement here. Issues are never the problems. Understand that? Issues are never the problem. Issues are simply coat pegs in which we hang our problems on. You see, I had, in quotes, a problem with the fellowship. I handed over responsibility to Terry, who's here this weekend, just over a year ago, 18 months ago. And I handed over leadership to him. And about 6 months ago, they were doing all sorts of things that were jarring to me. And I got more and more unhappy about the situation. But I know the issues are not the problem. So I went for a walk with the Lord and I said, Lord, what is the problem? It's not these things. What really is the problem? And the Lord said, you just feel unwanted. And I said, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I feel unwanted. Now, why I was feeling unwanted got nothing to do with the folk there. That was another thing in itself. But that was the real problem. And what I was doing was hanging this particular problem, picking up little things in the church, or even big things, and hanging this thing on it. Really. So I had these couple of leaders come to me in church, and they were talking about issues. And I said, the issues are not the problem. Basically, let's get to the problem. And when we began to talk, and they began to open up what real problems, Then we began to uncover all sorts of things which were not, had hurts that had not been resolved and everything else like this. Boy, we began to sort some things through. And if we do not resolve them, and there was some anger there and there was some resentment there, and they had been just ignoring this and had been working away underneath, constantly working away, and they just needed to deal with it. Thank God they decided to do something about it. And suddenly the issues didn't become a problem to them. What they actually had come to talk to me about was no longer a problem, because we began to get to the root. And we really need to give and make sure that we're not giving Satan room, especially in the area of unresolved anger and hurts. Now, an overemphasis on corporate growth will lead to an exaggerated subjectivism, self-centeredness, and the withdrawal from the world. We will just become a clique. Underemphasis on corporate growth will mean that we'll get converts with little change in their lifestyle, or a lack of discipleship or lost fruit, if we don't really pay attention to the need for corporate growth. Now, the Howard Snyder quote, which I used yesterday, evangelism is sharing life, and a church cannot share what it does not possess. The church must be good news before it can proclaim good news. Now, corporate growth and some of its hindrances. Now, finally, numerical growth. Growth in size. I'm talking about growth by conversion, not by transference. In the what is euphemistically called the house church movement, most of the growth that has taken place has taken by transference, not by conversion. And we're fooling ourselves when we talk in a lot of situations about growth, because all that's happening is the population is shifting around. And somebody said, a house church friend of mine says that they have become a finishing school for evangelicals. Or they can become a finishing school, would be better to say. Now, I'm really talking about growth by conversion. There must be a stimulus for growth. That is, there must be the right environment, something that is culturally relevant. A love for neighbor, where growth has got to be seen not because of duty or desperation. No, if we don't get growth, how are we going to maintain the church's budget? Now, in the house church, the difficulty is coming of changing the environment or changing the mood. Because the house church movement really has been born out of a need to relate rather than a need to proclaim. Understand that? That's what it's really come out of. The Wesleyan revival was more born out of a need to proclaim, I think. But the house church movement has been born out of a need to relate, or to need to work through some of the things that we knew but didn't really, in the kind of climate we're in, had the opportunity to work through. But basically, that's where we've come from. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but the difficulty is that if we have been born out of that, the difficulty then is to change the emphasis or to change the mood. The difficulty of changing from a liner to a battleship. I said of our own fellowship when we came into existence that we were really not even a liner, we were a hospital ship. It was like asking a whole load of patients to run the National Health Service when most of us needed to be in intensive care. we were hurting so much. I mean, basically, that's what it was all about. And we had to work all that through. or I did, as well as lead a few hundred people, you know, when I wanted to crawl into a corner and lick my wounds. But the need or the environment in which we are in, there has to be the right stimulus for growth, and therefore there has to be the right strategy for growth. You have to change the mood, and that doesn't come easily. It's taken us basically a year. I predicted it would take a year. Perhaps if I'd predicted it would take 6 months, I might have done it in 6 months. But I felt it would take at least a year to change the mood of our fellowship from what was basically an inward caring to something that was outward sharing. It took about a year. It doesn't happen by somebody standing up and saying, "Look, folks, we're going to be evangelistic from now on." It takes a while to change the mood. And incidentally, you may have to get somebody in the fellowship who is the mood setter, who's somebody who can create that kind of mood. I doubted whether I actually could create that kind of mood. I believe that Terry could. That was part of my thinking in handing over responsibility. I felt that it was a time for a change of mood, and that was one of my considerations. So there needs to be a change of attitude. It needs to be something that is taught, which is stimulated over a long period. You need to change structure. That if the structure of your fellowship is geared up simply to basically caring for what you have, you may have to change the structure. You may have to, if you change from being a liner to a battleship, then you have to forego some of the luxuries. Not the necessities, but some of the luxuries. And if you've been over a battleship, as I have, you'll realize just how many luxuries have been foregone in order to meet with the necessities. And you really need to work on that, to change the structure. To change the emphasis of resources. You cannot, at the same time, really start to think in terms of growth if most of your resources in terms of manpower and money and everything else actually is going somewhere else. There has to be an investment of manpower. When I was at the previous church I was at and leading it for a while, I was always trying to grapple with this thing. And we worked out, I asked the staff to work out, how many people in a membership of about 600, how many people were involved in actually keeping the thing going? And they came back with the answer. We had over 300 people involved, teaching Sunday school, doing all sorts of things, leading house groups, what have you. Over 300 people out of 600. We had so many people running the ship, we had no one left to fire the guns. Because it wasn't simply a straightforward, well, half and half, because the half that were actually running the ship, you guessed it, were the most capable and most committed of the people and the most mature. That's why they were doing it. So the most mature, capable, committed people were involved in keeping the thing going, which meant that in terms of impact in our society, we were having very little. Now we had to change. We would have had to change the resources. And one of the emphasis that we had when we came into existence as a fellowship now was out of the citadel into the city. You know, there had to be a release of resources if this is going to happen. And if you're going to experience corporate numerical growth in your fellowships, there has to be a shift, not only of emphasis, but a real shift of resources. And some of the most able people, there has to be a shift in terms of money and commitment to doing this thing, because otherwise it's not going to happen. And there has to be, we have to adopt a strategy that is consistent with the commission. Finally, and we're all getting tired, hindrances, social and spiritual climate. We live in a consumer society, which is basically a gimme society. You know, what can you do for me? That's the kind of society in which we live. And for most of us, the church situation is very similar. What can I get out of it? What benefit is it going to be for me? Type of attitude. Also, there is a resistment and resentment to change. All folk are basically resistant to change. And the older you get, the more resistance you get to change. That's a psychological fact. Hindrances. Teaching that is largely man needs subjective rather than God, his purpose and objective. Another hindrance, failure to take the commission seriously. And failure to take Satan seriously. Now, an overemphasis. Sorry, I thought I'd put those up. An overemphasis upon numerical growth. An overemphasis on activity can cover up a primary need for the individual or corporate growth. A person who is activity-centered, activity-minded, very often that is covering up, not always, a primary need in his own life or her own life or her relationships. It is easier to be involved in that than to deal with this kind of thing. Very prone in Christian workers, by the way. An underemphasis becomes a stagnation, an excessive introversion, and becoming a clique, and a withdrawal, and ultimately irrelevant to the world. And if the house church and charismatic movement doesn't grapple with this one, what we are going to end up is, as someone says, an island of irrelevance in a sea of despair. What we will be doing will be totally irrelevant as far as the world out there is concerned. We will be an island of irrelevance in a sea of despair. Now that again is an underemphasis as opposed to overemphasis. Right. That's it. I don't know if you have any quick questions before we close. You've been very patient in a hot room, I must say. But any quick questions? Fine. Then what I suggest, if you find it helpful, take one of the leaflets, just follow it through, and maybe use it as a check against what's happening in your fellowship. But only if you're leaders in the fellowship, because I don't want to build up a head of frustration in people who are not in a position to influence change. That only creates problems. So don't use it as a stick to beat or to hang your personal difficulties on, as far as the fellowship is concerned. Right, thanks very much.